Okay, last week I gave an introduction to the book of Judges in which I tried to give maybe the way it fits into the history of redemption, and we didn't look at many of the details, but I tried to stress as it spoke of the failure of unity among the people of God as they rebelled against him. And as God raised up judges, that it was intending to point them forward to the true king, the Lord Jesus, who would rule faithfully and who had been promised earlier in their history. What I've done at the beginning here is list the different judges who are mentioned in the book of Judges and underline those who are, I guess, generally considered the major judges. Some of them are only mentioned by name. There's not much information beyond their names. About others we have a good bit more detail. So I thought today we would focus just a bit on Gideon. He's in the middle of the seven who are the major prophets, or major judges. But I thought I would read at the beginning something that helps us put into perspective the lives of these who served as judges. The writer to the Hebrews, after describing men and women of faith in the earlier period of the Old Testament. So, you know, his Old Testament survey by verse 32, he hadn't gotten this far either. So, I mean, he just barely gotten here. So, you know, we have a precedent. In fact, he says in verse 32, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets." And then he goes on to list a variety of things, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, and it goes on from there. It's not clear how to connect all the specific actions with those who were immediately before mentioned, but it is clear that these men, especially Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, are praised as men of faith. And that's important to realize because they, of course, have their failings. And as we'll see, even Gideon had his failings. There are two errors that you could make, I suppose. One is to say that they were not faithful men for their failings, but that's clearly not the case. They are praised here as men who acted by faith. And the other would be to tend to justify what they do, whatever it is they do, because they're described here as men of faith. And in a sense, Jeff touched on this when he talked about Rahab, who was praised for her action with respect to the spies, and yet on the basis of that, you can't necessarily justify the lies that she told. I'm not intending to reopen that issue, but I think that's an example of where it's improper to read back a general description of faith to justification of specific actions. But my main point is that these are men of faith, and as we look particularly at Gideon, you can see the way he responded to God's word in a way that is pleasing to God. Before we look at Gideon, I thought we'd look at one other thing, and this is, I guess, more for amusement. But if you turn with me to Judges chapter 12, verses 5 and 6, this is not in the time of Gideon, but in the time of Jephthah. It is useful to sometimes to think about how the Bible, simply as literature, has worked its way into the English language and culture, and Western culture. And the word shibboleth is probably not used a lot, but it's an example of a word which is fairly, or at least used to be fairly familiar. A shibboleth is some belief or other practice that would separate one group from another. And it comes up in connection with the judge named Jephthah. In Jephthah, in chapter 12, verse 1 of Judges, the men of Ephraim gathered together and crossed over toward Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and did not call us to go with you?" Well, this is an example of the disunity we talked about last week. Here they are, you know, they've had a victory, and these guys come over and say, "Hey, you didn't call us to the," well, it wasn't a party, but to the fight, you know. What is the big deal? We should have been involved in this. And unlike Gideon, whom we'll see had a soft answer that turned away wrath, Jephthah doesn't have quite the soft answer, although it's not exactly provocative. In any case, there is a battle that ensues. So this is an aspect of a civil war. One group in Israel is fighting against the other. And the ones that have come over to argue with Jephthah have crossed over this this body of water. I think, is it mentioned specifically?
The
fords of the Jordan, okay. And then after the battle, they're fleeing back, and that's where this this reference to the Shibboleth comes in. So let me read verses 4, 5, and 6. Now Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. Those were the ones who had complained to him. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, "You Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites." The Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan, there we are, before the Ephraimites arrived. So the Ephraimites are trying to get back home, to cross back over Jordan at the fords. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he said, "No," then they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he could not say, and he would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. Then they would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. There fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. Apparently it wasn't that this, as a group, they had a list. There was a well-known alteration in the pronunciation of certain words among regions, not just within Israel, but elsewhere. And so that accounts for the difference in pronunciation. But this idea of Shibboleth, which has to do, the meaning is something like fords of a stream. So it's, they probably point at this and say what this is, and the guys couldn't get it right. I was amused. F.F. Bruce, who has a commentary on the book in the New Bible Commentary, gives another example, which would probably tie in with Jeff's church history class. He says, similarly, in the border wars between Scotland and England, a Northumbrian intruder in Scotland was immediately detected by his speech when he responded to the invitation to pronounce the word tree and was summarily dealt with. So that's not a deep theological point, but it is interesting, again, to see how you can't really understand Western culture and literature without knowing what the Bible, what's in the Bible. I'm not going to attempt the pronunciation. If Simon were here, I'm sure he could help us. I would guess it has to do with trilling R's. Is that the guess? But I can't trill my R's, so I don't know. Okay. Let's do take some time to look at Gideon. So turn back with me to Judges chapter 6. And as I said, this will necessarily be brief because we want to look at the beautiful book of Ruth. So I'm not going to look at his life in detail, Gideon's life in detail, but I want to think a bit about the amazing work that God did through him. Now, the introduction at the beginning of chapter 6 tells the same story that we saw was the cycle throughout Judges, that is, of rebellion against God and his subsequent delivering them to the hands of oppressors, foreign oppressors. So, Judges chapter 6, verse 1, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. And then it goes on to talk about how the Midianites would destroy the harvest that they would have been anticipating. And they're described as numerous as locusts in verse 5. And then verse 6 is that the next part of the cycle as it's described in the beginning of the book of Judges. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So here is the great mercy of God, his covenant faithfulness, as we again discussed last week, because he shows mercy to them. And actually, this is a little unusual. He doesn't always send a prophet, at least it's not recorded that way. But here in verse 7 it says, and it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice." So this is really a repetition of the law. There's much in common here with the saying that was given at the preamble to the Ten Commandments. God calls them to their covenant obligations. And he reminds them of what he has done for them. And yet they have refused to obey his voice. And then what follows that is, strikingly enough, an appearance of an angel of the Lord, a theophany. It's clear as you read through this passage, and I'm not going to be reading a lot of it, that this angel of the Lord really should be in capital A angel, because of the way Gideon addresses him ultimately and of the worship that's accepted by the angel. So God himself comes in human, it's hard to say in what form, but in the form of an angel, comes to Gideon and addresses him. Gideon is here, I always thought this was amusing, here is Gideon hiding out, threshing the wheat in the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel says to him in verse 12, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." You know, it's amazing what God's grace does, because he is a mighty man of valor in the end, isn't he? God's grace raises him out of hiding from the Midianites, which in itself, it's not a bad idea to hide. You know, if you're going to have something to eat, you probably had to do something like that. Yet God graciously comes to him and calls him a man of valor. Gideon's response it's not clear exactly how much of it is in a complaining spirit and how much is in the spirit that you see in the Psalms sometimes of asking, "Oh Lord, what is going on?" Now, they ultimately should have known what was going on, but Gideon asked, "Where are all the miracles which our fathers, God's miracles which our fathers told us about?" And the Lord responds to him. There's another, by the way, illustration of who this angel is in verse 14. "Then the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?'" And that, of course, is ultimately what happens. God answers this question, but with a command, "Go, and in this might of yours, you will save Israel from the hand of the Midianites." Now, the story that follows, I'm assuming, is fairly familiar. Gideon questions his own ability. He says, "How can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." And there's the great promise of God, which is always our comfort, "Surely I will be with you." And that's enough. God's promise that he will be with him, and that he would defeat the Midianites as one man. And then there's a description of the offering which is presented before the angel, and Gideon's ultimate realization in verse 22, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face," fearing that he would not survive the experience. Now, that sets the scene. It's the first act of Gideon at the command of God is to destroy an idol. Now, if you look at it, you'll realize this is the idol that his father had built. So this is a difficult call for Gideon to fulfill, because he has to not only be an iconoclast, that is to destroy idolatry, but it says in verse 25, "The altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it." Apparently his father did have some position of influence, even if he wasn't officially a leader. So Gideon, although he does it at night, he does it and destroys this, and the men of the city are upset. And there's one of these fairly frequent jabs at idolatry, which you can see through the scriptures, where Joash, the father of Gideon, says, "Well, you know, if Baal can't help himself, I mean, he's really a pretty sorry God. Why don't you let Baal take care of it if you think we ought to take the vengeance on Gideon?" So Joash says in verse 31, "Would you plead for Baal? Would you save him?" It's a really strange mixture here, which is not that uncommon, unfortunately, the mixing together of different religions. Here's the man who built the altar of Baal, or at least who has it, and yet he himself is pretty willing to abandon defending Baal to the last throw. Okay, then the battle itself and the description of what happens is takes up most of chapter 7. The last part of chapter 6 is the, well, first, the calling by Gideon, and it lists the people whom he calls. This is significant for a later conflict. In verse 35, he sends messengers throughout Manasseh, that would be his own tribe, and also Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. The rest of the chapter is about the seeking the Lord's confirmation by means of a fleece, since that may perhaps receive more discussion than anything else about Gideon. I'm just going to skip over it. It doesn't tie in with the part of the story that I want to emphasize. But the Midianites were a tremendous group of people. They were already mentioned as being as numerous as the locusts. And this was an overwhelming task for them. The Midianites were related to the Israelites. Midian himself was the son of Abraham by Keturah. After Sarah died, he married Keturah. So they were distant cousins in some sense. But the Midianites tended to be semi-nomadic. They had apparently settled down somewhat, but they had, we talked a little bit about the technology. In this case, their technology was camels. They were able to do these raids by means of the camels that they had, and there's a mention of them. I believe it's in chapter 7. Although they were so numerous and so used to raiding, God finds that the 32,000 people that Gideon has gathered are too many. And so it says in verse 3, first of all, that Gideon is to tell whoever is there that, and fearful and afraid, he should turn and depart from Mount Gilead. So first of all, those who are not, shall we say, confident about the battle were invited to go home. And of the original group, then it says at the end of verse 3, 10,000 remained. Well, why did God do this? Well, we don't have to wonder, because it says in verse 2, I skipped this over, the Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now, God knew well enough the human heart as well as the history of his own people that this was a constant temptation. And so God reduces the numbers first to 10,000, and of course later on in the chapter he reduces them to 300 against this huge army which is nearby, or, well, soon to be nearby. So there's an interesting description of the way they get the water. That was the way of distinguishing among those who would be included and those who wouldn't. At the end, it says in verse 7, by the 300 men who lapped, this is the way they drank their water, out of this body of water, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. Then you see, again, God's encouragement to Gideon, a man of faith, but all men of faith need encouragement. And so God says to Gideon in verse 10, if you are afraid to go down, then go down to the camp with Purah, your servant. And this is an interesting thing. They go down into the camp at night. They hear one of the Midianites telling the other, I've had a dream. And a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. And it's interpreted by his companion as saying, this is Gideon. You know, Gideon is probably saying, whoa, I had no idea they even knew I was here. You know, I've got these 300 guys. When Gideon hears this in verse 15, he worships. He acknowledges that God indeed has clearly confirmed his promise. And he says, rise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand to the men when he gets back. Now, dreams are significant in that culture especially. I know the McCulloughs, when they've talked about the Muslim culture, emphasize how seriously that part, it's not exactly the same area, but takes dreams. And this would have been the same thing, presumably, for the Midianites as well. So Gideon goes, and there's the trumpets that are blown, as well as the pitchers, which are covering the torches. So they blow the trumpets, they break the pitchers, and suddenly this camp sees these 300 lights shining in this, hear the trumpets and this, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And the whole army ran and cried out and fled. and it's a remarkable victory. Now they pursue them, and I'm not going to follow the story much further, but let me make one other comment. If you look at the beginning of verse 8, you can see, again, this example of disunity, which plagued the people at this time, as I argued last time, flowed from a failure of the of their faithfulness in worship and of the teaching ministry of the priests and Levites. But at the beginning of chapter 8, it says, "Now the man of Ephraim said to him, 'Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?' And they reprimanded him sharply." Now, this is a lot like what we had just read, although that's later in the book, when we looked at the Shibboleth. Okay? They're complaining that they were left out of the battle. And look at what he says to them. In verse 2, he says, So he said to them, "What have I done in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Well, this is an example of Proverbs 15:1, "A soft answer turns away wrath." And I was interested, I looked at the Westminster Larger Catechism and the question on the sixth commandment about preserving life. One of the things that's commanded is to do exactly this. And they actually cite this passage as an example of an answer, which is, I can't remember the word they use, but it's a conciliatory sort of thing. He's not buttering them up. They actually had accomplished something, which is described at the end of chapter 7, which we didn't read. But he could, of course, have said, "Hey, you know, I'm the man. You know, I call people who I want to." But instead, he very graciously diffuses the situation and encourages them with the work that they had done. The rest of the chapter has to do with the pursuit of two of the other leaders, Zeba and Zalmunna. Two were captured, but two others are still being pursued through a good bit of the rest of chapter 8. Let me just make one other comment, and then we'll be done with Gideon. I mentioned last time that at the end of his life there is an unhappy connection with idolatry. And it's not clear exactly how Gideon took or what he intended with this, but it certainly ended up as being, as it says, a snare for the people. And that's beginning at verse 22 of chapter 8. So we looked at this last week. Gideon's, again, a wise answer. The people said that they wanted him to rule over them, and they were looking for a dynasty. Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson. And Gideon said, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." God was the theocratic king, properly understood, and in his wisdom at this time period, there was not to be the raising up of the monarchy, although he had promised that ultimately. And Gideon knew his station, he knew his calling, and declined their offer. But then he makes a request of them. They had a lot of plunder in golden earrings. And what Gideon gathered from them in verse 24 and following is that gold. And it says in verse 26, "The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks." Then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. And then the verse 28 really concludes the description of Gideon. There was a period of quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Now, the word ephod is, as we usually think of it, it has to do with the priestly garment. And that was connected with various things, but partly with discerning the will of God. It's a little unclear even from the description and the law, but that seemed to have been part of its function besides being just the clothing that the priest would have worn. So it's possible that what Gideon had in mind here was a use for divination or something like that. For a godly man, you know, you want to put the best construction you can upon his actions. Whatever he had intended, the sad consequence was given in verse 27. all Israel played the harlot with her there, and it became a snare, not just to Israel, but to Gideon and to his house. I thought I would read what Matthew Henry has to say, because Matthew Henry makes an attempt in his commentary to say, you know, for the saints of God, you don't want to jump to the worst possible conclusion, but there is something to learn about it. And he says, first, Israel went a whoring after it. That is, they deserted God's altar and priesthood, being fond of change and prone to idolatry, and having some excuse for paying respect to this ephod, because so good a man as Gideon had set it up. And by degrees, their respect to it grew more and more superstitious. Note, many are led into false ways by one false step of a good man. It's a very important comment. The beginning of sin, particularly of idolatry and will worship, is as the letting forth of water. So it has been found in the fatal corruptions of the Church of Rome. Therefore, leave it off before it be meddled with. And then the second point is, it became a snare to Gideon himself, abating his zeal for the house of God in his old age, and much more to his house, who were drawn by it into sin, and it proved the ruin of the family. And he may have in mind there particularly not only what's mentioned here, but Abimelech, his son, who does accept the kingship, and the subsequent chapters describe the mess that he makes of things. Again, I think it's instructive to look at this example of one judge who was a faithful man who exercised, who acted in obedience to God. I would not like to go with 300 men against an army like that. I'm not even sure I'd like to creep into the camp at night with people like that. And yet Gideon believed God's word and acted faithfully. And yet even the 40 years of that he won, that God won by his hand, was only temporary. And this reminds us again that we long for Christ, who does secure the victory, whose kingdom is certain, whether it's on the larger sense of accomplishing the purpose in redemption of all things, or even for individuals, that his purposes will not fail. He will see us through to the end. Okay, any comments or questions? I don't know if I dare say about judges as a whole, but maybe about what we've talked about so far today. There's a lot in the book, but I felt maybe picking out one example would give us an idea. Any comments or questions? Okay. Let's turn over to the book of Ruth, of course, the next book in the Bible. And this is not although some of my, you know, sometimes when the teacher goes from one topic to the next, it's just artificial. Like, that's where I finished, and now this is where I'm going to pick up. This is not completely artificial, because the book of Ruth covers the same time period as the book of Judges. You can see that even in the first verse of the first chapter. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. So the time period covered in the book of Ruth is included in the time period that we were just looking at in the book of Judges. And as I mentioned last week, this is a great, it's not a counterpoint exactly, but it lets us see that God not only was faithful to his people in providing judges periodically, but he was also faithful in preserving a remnant. So you see a man like Boaz, who knew what the law was and followed it. And in some ways, not the best of circumstances for him, and yet by the end of the book, you see the blessing that comes on a man like Boaz for his faithfulness. So this shows how God preserves a remnant, and how he still has in view, especially if you look at the end of the book, the coming of the Messiah. The genealogy of David is given there, looking forward to the great son of David. The book of Ruth, just as literature, is a jewel. It's beautifully written. The language is very carefully chosen. There are all sorts of things in the names and in the words which are important in themselves. That's not saying it's not history, but the names are themselves significant. So even to get started, you have to remind yourself of a little bit of the basic story. They were there. There was a famine in the land, and there's a man of Bethlehem. Well, Bethlehem means house of bread, but there wasn't any bread in the house of bread. They had to leave and go to Moab. And so it says in verse 1, he went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, the man's name is given in verse 2. That was Elimelech. Moab was not a preferred destination for Israelites. Okay, so Moab was also a person who was related to the Israelites. Right, he was a son of Lot by Lot's daughter, an example of incest. And the Moabites had not gotten along well with the Israelites, shall we say, over time. Here, apparently, there was relative peace between the two. The man and his family goes over. But we don't have a lot of hope for the health of the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon means sickly, and Chilion means wasting away. And sure enough, within a few verses, they're dead. Before they die, however, they had married women of Moab, Orpah and Ruth. And so, at the end, Elimelech has died, the two sons have died, and here we're in this unusual circumstance that Naomi, did I say the names properly? Naomi, who was the wife of Elimelech, Naomi, the Israelite, is there in Moab with these two women who are not Jews, they're not Israelites, they're Moabites. And so she herself has no connection to the land. She is ready to go back. It's time to return, as it says in verse 6, the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. And Naomi very graciously comes to them and says, just go back to your mother's house. There's no need for you to come with me. May the Lord deal kindly with you, she says in verse 8, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And she expresses a desire that they would then find husbands for themselves. There's obviously a great amount of affection on both sides here. They lift up their voices and wept. I'm sure part of that's a different cultural expression, but it's clear that there's affection among the three of them. And she talks them out of going back with her. And this is an interesting description. Would you wait until I, had a husband and had another son and the son grew up? And interesting the way she says it. Orpah takes her suggestion. Ruth clings to her. Now, part of the context here is that although the Moabites are descended from Lot, they were not known as being faithful to God. They were given over to idolatry. They did not have the line of the covenant promises, and God did not preserve them as a nation from that. They were largely given over to worshiping other gods. And you can see that in verse 15 even. Naomi says, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And there's the beautiful statement in Ruth that Ruth makes in verse 16. Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. But fundamentally, she's making a profession of faith there in the God of Israel. Your God, my God. Your people shall be my people. She's identifying herself with the covenant people of God. Now, you have to understand the history of redemption, okay? At this time, being an Israelite was the means of access to God's blessing, right? I mean, it wasn't just that becoming a Jew was the thing. It was that it was God's covenant promises through Abraham, and she was identifying herself then with that work of redemption that God had promised to accomplish. And yet that did necessitate, in her case, abandoning her country. The point I'm making is, it doesn't mean like if you're going to be converted, well, you have to go and become an American or become an Israeli or something like that. In our day, we don't really have the same orientation, but there God had chosen to work through one specific people, although he gathered in others from the nations. And so her commitment was not merely a religious profession. It was a complete abandoning of her own culture and her own people, to the point of where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. So it's a very amazing statement that she makes, and a radical, the word is overused, but it is a radical commitment she makes to cut herself off. Radical has to do with, from the roots. She takes herself from that, her own culture, and
and goes over to worship the true God. And comes back and, see, I just spent almost 10 minutes of my 20 on this first hit. It's such a wonderful book, so let me try to go a little bit more quickly. I'm hoping the story is familiar with you. She goes back, and of course, it's not that they're just sitting pretty here. Here are two women who have, in that situation, really no means of gaining wealth for themselves, except for the merciful provision of the law. The merciful provision of the law was that you could go and glean in someone's fields. And this is not easy work. Okay? This is not a simple matter. And Ruth says herself, she shows the initiative in verse 2, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor. And I'm not giving all the context. It said at the end of chapter 1, it was the beginning of the barley harvest. And the reference is to Naomi's, is to a relative of Naomi's husband, this man Boaz, whom I've already mentioned. So Ruth says she wants to go do this work. And by God's providence, she picked the right guy. You know, it wasn't just a lucky chance. She comes to a man who whose reapers don't abuse her. You can imagine a young woman in a situation like that was very vulnerable. But they treat her well, and he specifically addresses them on the subject and encourages them to treat her well. And Boaz notices what she's doing in chapter 2. He says to her, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. And he encourages her. And she responds in humility in verse 10, why have I found favor in your eyes? And he goes on to describe what he knows of her conversion and of her care for her mother-in-law. And says, there are lots of beautiful statements in Ruth, but verse 12 of chapter 2 is one of them that's especially interesting. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. There's a picture that's used in the Psalms and elsewhere in the Old Testament of God as some sort of a bird who, under whose wings his people can shelter for refuge. Now, she has success in her gleaning. She comes home, and her mother-in-law is impressed at how much she had, and they discuss this the man, Boaz. But really, to get into the heart of the story, I'm going to have to skip down to verse 20 of chapter 2. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. And Naomi said to her, this man is a relative of ours, one of our close relations. Now, the word you have there may differ somewhat in the translations, a kinsman or something like that. The word that's used is an interesting one. It's the word goel, which is really a redeemer. Now, literally it means a near kin, someone closely related to you. But the idea of the Redeemer comes in significantly in the law in different ways. And I put up some references here in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 25. One function of the near of kin was, well, as a blood avenger. If one of your family was unjustly killed, and there was an allowance in the case of accidental manslaughter, I guess we would call it. But it was a kinsman redeemer who would go out and avenge the person. And this was not specifically commanded in the law. It was a practice, one of other practices, which was, in a sense, regulated in the law. But that's one example of how the word is used, this kinsman redeemer. Probably closer to what's going on in Ruth is that if a person had lost a property, then the kinsman redeemer was supposed to come to the aid. And let's look at one of these passages. Let's look at Leviticus chapter 25. There's a lot, actually, in here, a lot of provision in the law for poor people. And I tried to emphasize that a little bit when we looked at the case law. If one of your brethren, I'm reading at Leviticus 25, verse 25, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative, okay, so there's the word goel, comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the year since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. And it goes on through there. You can read through the passage, but for example, if you look toward the end at verse 49, this is referring to, I think, a slightly different situation, but it's the same context. One of his brothers, in verse 48, may redeem him, or his uncle, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or anyone who is near of kin to him and his family may redeem him. Or if he is able, he may redeem himself. Now, that had to do with the practice we talked about of selling yourself as a limited term slave. I'm not sure what is not a slave in the sense we use the word. So there's the provision in the law. And that's what's going on here. When Naomi says this man is one of our close relatives, she's not just saying, hey, he's a cousin. We'll see him at the family reunion. She has an idea because they are in dire straits. Ruth can glean, certainly, but she's hoping for a longer-term provision. And so that's what's going on in verse, if you look in chapter 3, chapter divisions are a little bit artificial in the book of Ruth because the narrative flows so smoothly. So Naomi says in chapter 3, verse 1, Naomi says to her, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. And she tells her to prepare herself, wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go in to his tent. Now, to the Western mind, this sounds a little bit indelicate, but this was not an indelicate thing that she was told to do. The man was asleep. She went in. It says in verse 7, she uncovered his feet and lay down. Now, verse 8, it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And they have this conversation. Who are you? So she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. So here's the same idea of God as has her under her wing as the protector. And she says, well, take me under your wing, for you are a close relative. And that was enough of a, I guess I would say a technical term, being a mathematician, That was enough of the technical term that he knew what that meant. Oh, you're a close relative. He says, oh, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. He understands that she's suggesting a marriage relationship, and he's praising her for her, again, her desire not only for herself, but for her mother-in-law to do the wise thing. And he says in verse 12, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. And so there's a description of this interchange. It's in itself kind of interesting. In chapter 4, they gather the elders together. They call up this closer relative. He describes the land that can be redeemed. The closer relative says, sounds good to me. And then he says, on the day, in verse 5, Boaz says, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabite, as the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. And then the guy backs out. I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. Now, this is something I probably should have said at the beginning about the book of Ruth, is that it illustrates how the case laws of the Old Testament actually worked out in practice. Which is kind of interesting because there aren't a lot of occasions of that. So here and in other parts of the book, the gleaning, for example, you can see that. It's not clear exactly how closely they were following the letter of the law, but apparently the indication given is that the man must not only take the land, but must take Ruth as a wife, and that the name of Naomi and Elimelech and of the sons and so on, would be perpetuated through that union. It's not clear, again, exactly how that's connected with this law of the Levirate, where if a man dies without a male seed, then the brother was supposed to take the wife, and the name would be preserved through that union. But in any case, the man backs out, and there's this interesting exchange with the sandal in verse 7. And Boaz says in verse 9, "You are witnesses this day that I bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Kilian's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabite is the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren, from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day." So the rest of the book is sort of like the joy of a wedding ceremony and what follows. There's a blessing pronounced by the people who are there. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah. And they praise them, interestingly enough, mentioning Tamar, who bore Eli, the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. They were in that line. And then there's the description of Boaz taking Ruth to wife and the son that they have. Now, I'm not a good storyteller, and I feel like especially I butcher a good story like this, but I'd like to draw some lessons from it in terms of what God's purpose of putting this at this point in the history of redemption. And I've already mentioned just the preservation of a remnant, which is an important fact. But the fact that the kinsman redeemer provision, which was given in the law, is worked out here, is very important for us to understand. Christ himself in the New Testament, just a reference in Hebrews, is called our Redeemer. And certainly that has to do partly with a slightly different legal context, but it certainly would call to mind also the Old Testament background and the fact that Christ has done for us what Boaz did for Ruth and her household. So I thought I would read, again, when you don't have good words to say it, you read what Matthew Henry says. So listen to what Matthew Henry says in this portion, the last part of the book of Ruth. He says, "Our Lord Jesus is our Goel, our Redeemer, our everlasting Redeemer. He looked, like Boaz, with compassion on the deplorable state of fallen mankind. At a vast expense, he redeemed the heavenly inheritance for us, which by sin was mortgaged, and forfeited into the hands of divine justice, which we should never have been able to redeem. He likewise purchased a peculiar people, whom he would espouse to himself, though strangers and foreigners, like Ruth, poor and despised, that the name of that dead and buried race might not be cut off forever. He ventured the marring of his own inheritance to do this, for though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. But he was abundantly recompensed for it by his Father, who, because he thus humbled himself, hath highly exalted him and given him a name above every name. Let us own our obligations to him, make sure our contract with him, and study all our days how to do him honor." And again, I mentioned this earlier on, but let me make one other connection with the history of redemption, and that is just the genealogy that's given at the end of the book. You might wonder why in a beautiful story like this they would close with what to a Western mind might be a boring genealogy. But just as the kinsman redeemer idea wasn't just the cousin you saw at the family reunion, so the genealogy here has significance because, of course, it goes down. Starts with Perez, whom we had mentioned there, the child born to Tamar. But it goes down to David. And, of course, you'll notice who's in there. Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. So that unless there are gaps in the genealogy, which does not seem to be the case, Ruth had the honor of being the great-grandmother of David. And, of course, if you step back even further and notice the genealogy which is given in Matthew 1, you notice, have you ever thought about the women who are mentioned there? Tamar is mentioned there, not in the most honorable of circumstances, and yet she was in the line of, she bore a son who was in the line of David. Rahab is mentioned there, and mentioned actually as one begetting Boaz. Here the chronology is maybe a little bit unclear, but apparently the Rahab, whom we looked at in Joshua, was the mother of Boaz. And of course, Bathsheba and Ruth are also mentioned in that genealogy. So it's a striking thing that God takes to himself this foreign woman, gives her that faith which she expressed in such a radical commitment, and honors her with being in the line of David, and of course ultimately of the Messiah she would have looked forward to. Okay, well, it was tough, but I guess we have to do it briefly. Any comments or questions on Ruth? No? Okay.
I was just going to ask this kinsman redeemer, is related to the Levirate or law or not, or just seems to be applied this way?
It seems a little unusual in this case because the Levirate law seems only to require the actual brother, and this would be an extension beyond that. So what I read seemed to indicate that this was an adaptation of it. And even what Boaz says, he doesn't say explicitly you've got to marry her. That may have been a delicate way of putting it, but you know, he says what does he say? On the day you buy the field, you must also buy it from Ruth, the Moabitess. But the idea of perpetuating the name of the dead through the inheritance does at least, it's a little hard again for us to get a hold of, but it does indicate the idea of a connection, and his name would in a sense be lost through that. But I'm not completely sure about that point. I think it's considering the idolatry they fell into so frequently, it's more remarkable that they had any of the any of the law functioning and remembered very much of it. Okay, well, Lord willing, then we'll start on Samuel next week, and let's close in prayer.